Ex parte Milligan was about military commissions and whether we could go outside of the federal court systems to try people that we caught during wartime. This is obviously something that's been quite important and quite controversial during the wars on terror in terms of what should we do with enemy combatants, both those who are citizens and who aren't citizens. And so Milligan is a Supreme Court sort of precedent on when you can use military commissions and when you can't. And the court generally tried to follow that in making their decisions in 2004, 6, and 8 regarding the Bush administration's use of military commissions. In doing so, basically said no to the Bush administration four times in terms of how they wanted to treat our enemy combatants.
Is it useful overseas in any context? Because that actually would be in a war zone where war is active.
For the current purposes, not necessarily, no. Those would be treated completely differently. But when we get the enemy combatants back here, technically to Guantanamo Bay, to Cuba, that's when the Milligan decision would kick in, and the decisions in the Rasul, Hamdan, and Boumediene cases arguing that everybody who the U.S. has caught has the right to challenge their detention in the federal court systems.
Stuart, has the decision over the 150 years been useful in limiting government suppression of dissent as well?
Mostly not. Mostly the decision has been in abeyance. There are very few cases, some cases coming out of World War II and subsequently in the Cold War. Immediately after the Civil War, the radical Republicans read the Milligan decision as a threat to the Reconstruction policies of the government and took the jurisdiction away from the Supreme Court. And so that's how that was handled. So
in the South.
Correct. And so an interesting wrinkle on this is that civil libertarians tend to like Ex parte Milligan. Lost in that is the fact that there was no other federal jurisprudence to prevent the KKK from exercising a terrorist campaign against African Americans in the South. And so the radicals read Ex parte Milligan as a stripping of the ability of the federal government to protect African Americans. So what you have is there's no federal civil rights jurisdiction, so the military commissions were a way of preventing all white juries in the South from stripping African Americans of their rights after the Civil War.
In a place where civil order had broken down, allegedly.
Although the courts were open and functioning, it's just that they had all white juries.
A matter of definition.
Yes, exactly. And who gets to decide is the question. In Lincoln's vision, the executive gets to decide when there's a state of war. In Davis's friend's opinion, the courts get to decide that question.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Megan Leonard and Stuart Winger of ISU's Department of History and Politics and Government. Why did Davis get to write the decision?
He was assigned the decision and wanted the decision. He had been, during the war, actually he and another friend of Lincoln's, Samuel Treat, had been troubled by Lincoln's course of action. Not necessarily Lincoln's course of action. Lincoln allowed his subordinates quite a bit of leeway. And he, backing his subordinate, he backed General Burnside, who was more radical. And as people who study the Civil War, not an excellent field general either. And Burnside's policies were somewhat draconian, and Lincoln basically was caught in the middle. And his friends, Samuel Treat and David Davis, exercised a kind of letter-writing campaign behind the scenes to Lincoln to try to get him to lighten up on and grant habeas corpus petitions of people who were trying too young to be drafted and found themselves in the Union Army and these kinds of things, but also copperheads who criticized the Lincoln administration against Burnside's directive that they not do so. So that's the essential conflict there, and Davis was into it very early.
There are often references to the soaring rhetoric in Milligan. What makes it great writing?
Oh, I'm not sure it is great writing. I think it's a horribly ambiguous decision. On the one hand, Davis says that the Constitution is a law in war and in peace for all men, and that's the soaring rhetoric, but he doesn't really mean it in a sense. Then he scales that back in the same opinion, saying that it's only the law for men when the courts are opening and functioning and recognizing that there's an area of war where Bill of Rights rights would not be accorded to people. And so it's not especially clear law. And Davis himself said that he never intended to strike down military commissions in the South. So he at least pretended to be shocked by the fact that the radicals would take it that way. But I think any reasonable, politically astute person, as Davis was in the period, understood that this is how the decision would have been read, as an attempt to strike down radical Reconstruction.
And I think when Supreme Court justices are writing their opinions, they're very keenly aware of which opinions are going to become the most important and the most widely read and the most precedential. And so if something would set this apart, it's probably Davis's understanding that this matters. This matters a whole lot more than most of the decisions that he's writing. And we see that really throughout history in all sorts of cases. You can read so many of them, and you would find that those that have the most sort of precedential value tend to be written just a little bit differently. You know, there's Justice Scalia, who puts everything into every majority opinion and dissent that he has, but certainly the justices know, I better sort of step up my game for this type of question.
Then he did.
Yes.
Or he certainly tried to. He realized he was somewhat out of his league, I think, as a trial judge, and knew he was a trial judge, and said so in his letters, that he hadn't spent that much time in the appellate jurisdiction. And I think he floundered a little bit in the decision, which has led to some of the battles that have come hereafter. And another thing about the decision that's very interesting is to elevate the Bill of Rights in this way is also new. And most Americans think of the Bill of Rights as having been there from the beginning, but the Bill of Rights was largely silent in the antebellum period, one, because it didn't apply to states where most of the law was made, but also because we weren't in this kind of a liberal legal order. So under the common law, property rights, for instance, were not nearly as protected as they would be if one took the Fifth Property Clause of the Fifth Amendment as seriously as Davis appears to in Milligan. So Davis is at the beginning of a line of cases that really leads to the Warren Court in a way. It's a case that to me is almost anachronistic. Davis is doing something new with this opinion.
So does it follow along with what Lincoln started to do in the Gettysburg Address and reimagining the Constitution to create individual rights through federal powers rather than the state's rights and state decisions on what should control the person?
No, I think Lincoln and Davis are really at odds here. Lincoln, in the Gettysburg Address, says that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish for the earth. Lincoln is arguing for sweeping government power. He comes from a legal order of sweeping government power. And that's lost in our understanding of American history. Davis is arguing for something much more like a modern liberal sense of the political order, where government has to be limited. So I think Davis and Lincoln are in a real tug of war, a real substantive difference between the two on the nature of government. Lincoln, I think, believes in government power, and the limit on government power, if there is one, is the election, is the ballot box. And Davis is arguing that regardless of who's elected, a division of powers and a limit on government would be necessary. So I think they really come from different philosophical points of view, and the mystery for me is how Davis moves to what's really a Democratic Party position and a Copperhead position on the nature of the legal order. Davis sounds more like a Jeffersonian than Lincoln does.
And incidentally, these are the same discussions we had during the Bush administration, especially Cheney spent a long time sort of outlining this idea of what we call the unitary executive and giving the power, a significant power, to the executive branch, especially during wartime. And he did this with his attorneys, writing in all of these things like the power to torture and the power to have these military commissions and making more and more things secret. Because he make the same argument that this, especially wartime power, should be really centralized in the executive branch, and others, the Supreme Court and others, said we really need to do something to protect individual rights, even those rights of accused terrorists.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Megan Leonard and Stuart Winger of ISU's Department of History and Politics and Government. Are we ever going to have it be established, or are we going to continue to encounter the same arguments with slightly different rhetoric?
Almost certainly we'll have the same arguments. I'm not sure there's a decision that could clarify. There's no way the Supreme Court could come in and say, here are all of the conditions under which the president has this power or the Congress has this power. So over and over again, we'll have these same arguments about really where and how the power should be shared across really the three branches of government.
Is Milligan also useful in making distinctions between martial law and military law, military justice?
Absolutely. Lincoln really is establishing something like martial law and using the laws of war to define the commander-in-chief power. And Davis is arguing that in Indiana, by extension Illinois and Ohio, where the Copperheads were active during the Civil War, and it was kind of a low-level war terror campaign, Lincoln's arguing for executive power in that place and therewith the laws of war and martial law. I would say in make a distinction between Lincoln's position and Cheney's position that I think is very important. On the one hand, it looks like the Lincoln administration course of action might be exculpatory or precedential for Dick Cheney's position, but Lincoln's position is that the commander-in-chief is under the laws of war, and indeed the whole Constitution is under the laws of war. So while they're sweeping executive power for the executive claimed by the Lincoln administration, it's also a limiting factor. They can't torture. They have to subscribe to Emmerich Vattel's Law of Nations and accord combatants certain kind of privileges on the battlefield, etc. So while they're sweeping powers claimed by Lincoln to confiscate property and therewith by extension to emancipate the slaves, there's also a limiting factor. So Lincoln's very important in establishing what was the American position for 200 years, which is that the United States honors, respects, and sees itself as subordinate to the laws of nation and international law.
And then we see later, in response to the Supreme Court's initial decision saying that the Bush administration couldn't use military commissions, one thing they were fairly effective at doing is mobilizing Congress. So Congress passed the Military Commissions Act in response to the Supreme Court decision. Then, of course, the Supreme Court struck down parts of the Military Commissions Act because the way it was written didn't comport with their previous decisions, didn't comport with Milligan, still didn't grant habeas rights in the federal courts. So when the Bush administration saw limits on their executive power, they went through Congress and said, help us do this. Let's show some sort of legitimacy to how we want to respond to this. And the Supreme Court still said it's still not constitutional.
Are the ripples still happening in the legal field?
The ripples are kind of interesting because we aren't really moving anywhere, right? There's very few people left in Guantanamo Bay. Anybody who is there has the power to challenge their detention in the federal court system. The Obama administration has said multiple times they're going to shut down Guantanamo Bay, and they haven't been successful at doing that. So they're sort of in a pause waiting to see what happens. There are still trials happening, military trials happening in Guantanamo Bay. There's some of these combatants moving through the court system. Ultimately, though, many have been released because we found that they hadn't done anything wrong or weren't really what we thought they were when we first sort of took them during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Megan Leonard and Stuart Winger of ISU's Department of History and Politics and Government. After the legal ripples finish, comes the scholarship. How is scholarship taking up Milligan now in this new light?
Well, I'd say in sort of the constitutional or legal arena, it definitely got, I think, a reexamination during especially the 2004, 6, and 8 about how it might apply. Certainly there are significant differences between a civil war and a war we have overseas, but it's seeing new light and maybe some new respect in terms of what it meant for civil liberties and how a decision so early really helped to protect our civil liberties. So constitutional discussions and arguments and scholarship is sort of moving in that direction, thinking about what Milligan might mean today. And I think Stuart can address historically really where it might be.
Yeah, for historians, this comes at a time when the Civil War is really being reimagined. We often imagine the Civil War past in light of our most recent war. And in response to the war in Iraq, the Civil War field has really been shaken up. So if you think about Billy Yank and Johnny Reb, or even James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom, the idea is that the war really ends at Appomattox Courthouse in a signing ceremony that's formal, and it all goes away. And that reflects the experience of MacArthur on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Harbor, that's how wars end. But in the wake of Iraq, we see that wars end in long, drawn-out, street-by-street, house-by-house terrorism and internecine strife. And historians are going back and looking at the Civil War period and saying, wait a minute, even in the North, there were communities that were riven between Copperheads and pro-administration folks, and newspapers in places like Bloomington, Illinois, were shut down by mob action. And that after the war, in many ways, the terrorists won, with the KKK establishing white racial supremacy in the South. So instead of a triumphant narrative of American unambiguous victory in unconditional surrender grant and this kind of mythology, we're looking at the war as really having been a war on terror. And the period of the Civil War has been extended all the way to Plessy v. Ferguson in 1898, and if the terrorists don't win, the terrorists certainly get a vote. And that reflects on-the-ground experience both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. We don't get to dominate and impose our will on another people, even when we, quote-unquote, win a war. That leads to questions about just how extensive was the threat of terror. And unlike the constitutional legal people, the historians are much more sympathetic to Lincoln's position, I think, because Lincoln has to protect black freedom. And his only tool is the military. And that's true of Grant as well. There are losers in a radical civil libertarian point of view. And one of the papers in the conference that I'm looking forward to, C. Petlak is going to talk about the fact that in the occupied cities of Cincinnati, Baltimore, and New Orleans, the restriction of white civil liberties allowed the efflorescence of black civic life. So by throwing somebody in jail the minute they crack a racist joke or call somebody the N-word and hit them on the head with their cane or more serious violations of black civil liberties, the minute you prevent white people in these cities from doing that, black people are able to establish newspapers, churches, civic organizations, and run for office, and it transforms temporarily the fate of black civic life in those cities.